San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB, presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future. Now, It's Your Money, Not Theirs on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
Good evening, everybody. This is Richard Muzio, all by his lonesome. Joe Vecchio is not in tonight. And I've got a great guest, Rich Gaines. But I've got a couple of things. Rich, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks. But I've got to do a shout out to one of our recent guests. Actually, I've got to do something else first. I'm going to dedicate this show to my dog, Benny, my Neapolitan Mastiff. We had to put Benny down this afternoon because of heart problems. He was 9 and a half, 150-pound dog, Italian Mastiff with blue eyes. And that was really tough. So this show is in memory of Benny. Benny was my first running partner. I bought Benny for my youngest daughter, Demi's 7th birthday. She turned 16 in July, and I had just started to take up running then, and so Benny was my first running partner. We could both only go about a mile because he was so big, and so was I.
That's a tough thing when you have a dog that's lived with you for all those years.
Yeah, but so I appreciate that. So this show's in memory of my Neapolitan Mastiff, Benny, my first ever running partner. And so I don't start crying on the air. I'm going to do two shameless plugs for me and then a shameless plug for one of our recent guests. Two shameless plugs for me. The book that I co-authored with Greg Reed called The Rise went bestseller last Saturday after being 2 days on the market, and it's even more bestseller than it was a week ago. The Rise, R-I-S-E. Lead author is Greg Reed, R-E-I-D, on Amazon Books under the self-help category. Everybody go out and buy it. It's a great book. It's about never giving up. And it's about collaboration. And then my other shameless plug for myself, my YouTube video on accounting, which I put out about a week and a half ago, has over 20,000 views. It's the most interesting video you'll ever see on accounting. Actually, that's the most views any accounting video has ever gotten on YouTube. YouTube being somewhat of a, well, not exciting topic, but check out Richard Muzio on YouTube. Again, last name is spelled M-U-S-C-I-O. My interesting accounting video on YouTube. There's an oxymoron for you. Anyway, enough shameless plugs about me. Now a shameless plug about Junior Achievement here in San Diego. We had Tara Michener from Junior Achievement on about a month ago, and she was on the show about 2 weeks before the students from San Diego went back to Washington, D.C. to compete in the national finals. Rich, do you know about Junior Achievement?
I know a little bit about it, but not too much.
Yeah, great charity, because they basically teach financial literacy to students all the way from grade school up to high school. So I'm just going to read this. And a big congratulations to a couple of the teams here from San Diego from Junior Achievement. So everybody ready? On Thursday, August 2 at Washington, D.C.'s George Washington University, Junior Achievement celebrated teen entrepreneurs who own and operate companies created through the Junior Achievement Company Program. Both the Junior Achievement of San Diego and Imperial County's companies went on for wins. Castaways took home the second place prize, while Placemate won the Best Financial Performance Award. The second place winner for the Junior Achievement Company of the Award was the local company, Castaways, from Hermonium, I hope I pronounced that right, which converts recycled vegetable waste products into organic worm castings. That's worm, W-O-R-M. I'm glad I ate dinner 2 hours ago, but be that as it may. Placemate from Westview High School, which is up in Del Sur, who creates laminated place mats that help preschoolers learn shapes, letters, and numbers, won the Best Financial Performance Award presented by NYSE Euronext Foundation. The award is given, well, that would be New York Stock Exchange, Euronext Foundation. The award is given to the student team which performs best against a high level of set criteria, including profitability, stockholder expectations, employee earnings, product quality, leadership, and operational efficiency. So big congratulations to those two Junior Achievement teams for winning awards in 2012. And again, Tara Michener, who heads up Junior Achievement San Diego's programs, and their great program, BizTown, was on our show just about a month ago in late July, if memory serves. So that was really good news to see. We have a couple. We only have winners on this show, Mr. Gaines, including you. So.
I love these organizations that really do the experiential work where they work with students on building businesses and doing things outside of the normal learning environment.
Yeah, and frankly, Rich, you and anybody else listening tonight, you really ought to go watch BizTown in action. They bring students in. When I went, it was from a sixth grade class from my old elementary school out in Lakeside was in, competing with a number of other schools where kids, and much like... Well, in the spirit of collaboration, some kids follow, some kids support, some kids lead, but roles change. These kids take on roles to bring products out to the market. And just depending on the response from consumers, other children, other students, they win awards. And then, of course, that goes all the way from the local to the national level.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It gives them a lot of insights into who they are and what they can do for themselves and how they show up.
So it was neat stuff. So anyway, congratulations, Junior Achievement and Westview High School. In my neighborhood. All right, so our guest tonight is Rich Gaines. Every time Rich Gaines is on, Joe Becchio is not here. So it must be something personal, Rich.
I hope that's a good thing, maybe.
I know. You had the highest rated show ever last time, so maybe it's because Joe... I'm just kidding, Joe. So, Rich, short and sweet, tell us about what you do, because what you do is really interesting.
Well, thanks, Rich. Very shortly, we work with solopreneurs who want to become businesspreneurs. And what that means is that the solopreneurs are very much involved in working a job for themselves. And we want to see them break out of that and become owners of businesses, just like the Junior Achievement kids that you were just talking about and having those opportunities. And so we take those motivated and committed business entrepreneurs and then work with them later into life as well, to preserve and protect wealth for generations. And what's really exciting is we do that not only in our core legal work with our law firm, but we also have a company called Family Legacy Trainings where we do a lot of experiential workshops. And those experiential workshops are designed to involve the students and the people involved, people in the workshops, in the doing of activities, so that they really learn the experience from their own beliefs, their own ideas, their own cultures, as opposed to what we all know is the rote environment in the educational system, which is sit down, take a pen, take some notes, and then never remember most of what you've been given.
Yeah, don't get me started on that. That was precisely the experience my daughter Demi had in her sophomore year history class, where they got to recite all kinds of information, like the name of the first Russian spacecraft that went out in orbit, but nobody ever talked about what all of this meant.
Yeah, what it means and how it actually plays out. I mean, imagine if you were able to create an environment in a classroom where people take on different character roles and you actually set up kind of like a studio and where you can actually set up an environment where they're getting the experience of being in the rocket ship itself and doing activities in that rocket ship and what that means. The ability to remember that information is so much deeper and richer and more valuable than the straight academic learning environment.
I agree, but I promised I wouldn't bash the schools tonight.
That's okay. You leave that to me.
Yeah, I'll leave that to you.
Yeah,
so,
like that.
But you are an estate planning attorney, correct?
Yes, 26 years by training.
And so you are appropriately named, if your name is Rich Gaines, in my opinion, to be an estate planning attorney.
Rich Gaines, tax attorney. And the best part is my wife and I have twins that were born on April 15th, which is the tax day. So,
it's tax day. Yeah. So you were destined to become who you became, I think.
Exactly. It was a clear message that was sent. And that's the exciting work that we're doing for people now, really in looking at their legacies, looking at who they are, what they want, their purpose, their visions for their family. So it's very exciting. And one of the things, again, if I may do a shameless plug.
Go ahead.
Some of the work we've been doing in our experiential learning is we're moving to a one-day workshop next year, which is going to be called Mining for Millions, Business Prosperity. And so we're going to be working with business owners very deeply in looking at their mind map, their thoughts, beliefs, their actions, the business foundations, business basics, things like really developing a powerful 30-second commercial and driving deep into how that's going to develop. And the actions of successful business owners. And so we're continuing this work. Ultimately, we'll be moving into 2 and 3 day workshops. So it's very exciting for us.
That's good news. I'm going to continue the shameless plugs just so everybody knows how to get a hold of Rich. It's rich@familylegacylegal.com. Again, rich@familylegacylegal.com. Rich is also one of the very much appreciated sponsors of our show, and his phone number is 760-931-9923. That's 760-931-9923. So, Rich, let's talk about some of the challenges that business owners are facing with regard to building wealth, transferring wealth, perpetuating their values through their wealth. And I guess the first challenge that I would point to, because it's so simple to point to, it is this grotesque uncertainty that we are facing with regard to income tax and estate and gift tax laws, where we don't even know what the rules are going to be in about 124 days.
Yes, you and I have a lot of history, and we talk a lot about this. You know, when I first got into tax law, one of the reasons I did that is because I thought the tax law was changing would be a great environment to be able to keep it fresh, keep it unique, and enjoy the profession. But what's ironic is we've gotten to a point where all the changes that have occurred over the last several years have made it very, very challenging, not only for the business owners, but also for the planners. Because we find that a lot of times people are saying, well, you know, we really don't know what's going to happen. And so sometimes it causes paralysis in the decision-making process. So it becomes difficult to move forward and really do the right work for people. As you and I have talked about, we do have high net worth clients where they want to take advantage of most opportunities. And so where we stand in today's environment, as you mentioned, what was it, 126 days, I think you said?
Yeah, I think it's 126 days until January. It's around that.
December 31st.
We got an attorney and accountant in the room, so we're counting on our fingers, counting on our toes.
Whatever we have available. So we all know that back in 2001, George Bush implemented new tax laws, which were supposed to expire in 2010. Congress extended it for a couple of years. And so here we stand in this exact same position. And this, without being political, this is one of the dynamics of what's coming up with the election is, do we extend these tax cuts and these tax opportunities, or are we going to have an automatic increase in taxes? And those automatic increases are going to become not only for the income taxes, which will be going up, but also the reduction of the estate tax exemption from $5 million down to $1 million. So that's a major, major question mark that's going to be sitting out there for most planners, and how that affects people. So I know that a lot of the, some of the families that are in that position that can take advantage of that definitely are looking at making the proper gifts and doing the work with their families. I'd like to, if I may, I'd just like to add to that that I know a lot of the approach of most planners come from the tax perspective, but one of the things that we do that's very, very different is we want to look at the purpose and the vision and the goals of the family. We want to have those discussions before we get into the question of the taxes, because you really have to look at what are the benefits and what are the reasons that the family's doing what they're doing. Is it really for business transition? Is it just straight gifting? You know, what are those opportunities?
Yeah, and a couple of interesting comments along those lines. The first comment is, a lot of commentators are saying that the Bush tax cut sunsets will probably get punted even one more year down the road to, say, the end of 2013. And I want your opinion on this, Rich. I would argue, though, that that doesn't mean that a very high net worth family should delay gifting, because the economy seems to be at least indicating it might turn around. Asset values, in many cases, are going up, especially if you own real estate along the West Coast. So to wait another year to do gifting when asset values have maybe gone even higher off of their bottom of maybe 2 or 3 years ago doesn't make sense to me. I would also be sensitive to gifting a day or two before the law changes, because if economic substance is a part, like you mentioned, the reasons behind gifting beyond just trying to save tax, if you're trying to substantiate a good case with the IRS about why you did this, doing it the day before the rules change might not look as good as if you did it maybe a year before the rules changed. Oh, what do you think?
I totally agree with that. You know, it's always been my philosophy that we wanted to do the planning based upon the law that we know, not the law that we think might happen or the uncertainty. Again, it's very ironic. Back in 2009, I started dealing with some clients, and I started looking at, well, you know, nobody thought that they would ever let the estate tax law go to zero, which is what happened in 2010. And so a lot of the planners, including myself, made recommendations based upon that idea. And we were actually wrong in that assumption. So in a 25-year career, I had never done planning based upon what I thought was going to be, only what I knew what was. So I absolutely agree that because we know what we have today, we know that you can take advantage of a $5 million per person exemption, that's a massive amount of wealth that you can transfer and something that you can take advantage of. Whereas even if the, you know, the thinking is it might be deferred a year, but there's no certainty of that, so you're really taking a chance.
One more question that when we come back, but again, time for a break. It's Your Money, Not Theirs. Richard Musio with Rich Gaines. We'll be right back. Welcome back to It's Your Money, Not Theirs with Richard Musio. And our special guest, Rich Gaines, estate planning attorney. Also, a big shout out to our sponsors, UBS, Mr. Michael Quaranta and Drew Freitas. Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited, the CPA firm of Plato, Epic and Associates. We had a great show last week with Don Epic, CPA, and Paul Plato, CPA. Of course, Family Legacy Legal, Rich Gaines in the studio tonight. Regions Bank, Sean Puckett, Steve Sefton, thank you very much. Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics, and we're adding a new sponsor starting next weekend, but we'll announce them now. Mr. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, a great, great company that helps real estate owners improve their cash flow. So, Rich Gaines, one last comment on estate tax. And we were talking about this during the break. I've been saying for some time, ever since this 2010 year where we did not have any estate tax, if somebody so elected not to pay estate tax, but instead not get what's called step up in basis in assets that are inherited, I've been saying there's an outside chance estate tax could get repealed if we wound up with Republicans in the House, the Senate, and in the office, because with a $5.12 million exemption equivalent, it's predicted that only 3,500 taxpayers will die in the year 2012 and actually have to pay estate tax. There'll be a lot more estate tax returns, which is the Form 706 filed because of spouses dying that are married. In other words, first spouses passing away and portability and using up the first spouse's exemption. But the point is, in terms of families actually writing checks to the United States Treasury because somebody passed away in 2012, estimated only 3,500 taxpayers. Does it make sense to have a tax regime for 3,500 taxpayers?
Well, I think you've summarized it very well, and 3,500 taxpayers is really nothing. And I didn't look up the actual stats, but my memory is that we had that those 3,500 will pay somewhere around $40 to $60 billion.
Yeah, around there.
In terms of estate tax. So
right.
Really, that's a drop in the bucket when you talk about a $15 trillion deficit. So they have a lot of other things to worry about. You know, the whole idea of, as you may recall, of the estate tax laws was dealing with the family farms in the Midwest. And that's really where, you know, the whole idea of estate taxation came out of, and they wanted to help the family farm, make sure that the family farm wasn't destroyed and the transfer of wealth that occurs. So, you know, again, your summary was very apropos. And if we do get a total Republican president and Congress, that the likelihood of repeal could in fact happen. On the other hand, if it goes to 1 million, then all of the planners and CPAs become massively busy again, just like the old days.
Well, couple of comments. Back in the days when the exemption was only $600,000, we had about 110,000 families a year writing checks for estate tax. But I've never known a very successful farm or farming family to ever pay estate tax. And the reason why is because they hire brilliant people like Rich Gaines sitting here to my left.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. And the planning work is good. And, you know, it's interesting because we were dovetailing this idea of purpose and vision. And so even though there's no estate tax, that really actually doesn't change it. It probably makes even more important the idea that you really have to have a good document that reflects the purpose and vision of the family. And we take that one step further with our clients, and we talk about taking action on that plan. Because if you have a vision and you don't act on that vision, you really have nothing. And we see a lot of lawsuits and a lot of problems in the industry now because people didn't do it right.
Yeah, well, a couple of quick comments, and we're going to move off of the estate tax per se. The first comment is the estate tax is indeed voluntary. You can plan around it. You can plan to reduce it. You can plan to eliminate it if you want to do enough planning, unlike the income tax. The estate tax is indeed voluntary. And then the other issue that you bring up, and we'll talk about this later in the show, it's not really about, at least with the people we work with, it's not really about getting the family's money ready for the family. It's about getting the family ready for the family's assets, business, or money. And that's a big difference. Because if there's not a strong foundation in the family, well, good luck.
Yeah, and there's a great saying out there which is you can be involuntarily philanthropic, which means you can give your money to the government, or you can be voluntarily philanthropic and you can actually use the money for beneficial purposes, charities, the things that you're really passionate about. So there are the filing of the returns and the paying of the tax is not voluntary per se, but all the planning around it, of course, is perfectly legal and legitimate. And And you can avoid paying any taxes if you wanted to benefit a charity of your choice.
Yeah, somebody said to me the other day, I was speaking up in Newport Beach on Wednesday. They said, Richard, you can't voluntarily plan around the estate tax to get it down to zero for somebody who's worth $1 billion. And I said, yes, I can. All they have to do is put in their living trust in their will that when they die, 100% of their $1 billion goes to these different charities.
Goes to the charity.
Just how much estate tax you pay. The answer is zero. You pay none.
That's what Warren Buffett did.
Right. It's totally voluntary.
Totally good, yeah.
And if you don't have kids, it becomes even easier to maybe do that kind of planning. If you do have kids or other living people that you want to benefit, then it's not that simple. But the point is, it's totally voluntary, trust me.
So let's
change gears. I always, well.
Yeah, go ahead.
I hate bringing up technical terms on the air, but I'm going to. Because this is really important to talk about, and we probably won't get to it until after the break. But brief summary, Rich Gaines, what on earth is the Uniform Prudent Investor Rule?
Well, the Uniform Prudent Investor Rule was adopted back in 1992, and without making it too complicated, it was developed by a guy by the name of Harry Markowitz back in the 1950s, and he had crafted an economic model that dealt with how trustees, how fiduciaries are supposed to invest money, how they manage the money, how they invest the money. It was called Modern Portfolio Theory. And the whole idea is that in the past, what we used to have is that in measuring whether a trustee or fiduciary was doing their work good or bad, they would measure it by each individual investment. So if you bought a Qualcomm stock, or you bought a Microsoft, you bought or if you were a family business that had a lot of stock in your business, the trustee would be measured in whether they're doing a good job or not doing a good job, and whether that individual stock would go up or down. Modern portfolio theory changed that.
Great answer. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you why this is important, because it's very, very important. Again, we'll be right back with It's Your Money, Not Theirs, after this quick break. Welcome back to It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I'm here with our special guest, Rich Gaines, a Family Legacy Legal. He's one of our sponsors, along with UBS and many others. We very much appreciate that. When we went to the break, we were talking about this thing called the Uniform Prudent Investor Rule, and Rich did a great job of describing what that is. It's also known as asset allocation. But Rich, I want to ask a question point blank, because about 4 years ago when the markets crashed, there were a lot of investors and a lot of trustees for high net worth families who were invested in stocks and bonds, and they had some sort of asset allocation like 60-40 or 80-20 or whatever it was based on the purposes of the trust and the age of the beneficiaries and so on and so forth. And everybody got hammered. So why didn't it work?
They did. The idea of the modern portfolio theory was that we looked at total return in a portfolio. So the theory was that if you allocated your assets amongst different classes, such as bonds and stocks and large cap, mid cap, small cap, that type of thing, that you wouldn't get hurt as much by having that diversified portfolio. Well, I love this question, because when we start looking at history, and unfortunately, I guess I'm revealing my age by talking about this, but
you and I combined are over 100 years old.
We are, and unfortunately, so back in you know the 1990s, what was the environment that was occurring? Well, we had a very dynamic, booming, high technology success, and so the stock market was rising from 1992 really into until 2000, until we had that first hit. So you could throw a dart at a stock and pretty much be successful. Well, 2000 really was the precursor to 2008, and it was really in a single class. It was in the high-tech environment. We really didn't have a complete collapse of the entire market at that time. So then real estate started growing, and so by 2008, people were still using the idea of the total asset modern portfolio theory asset allocation model. Well, by 2008, when all of the derivatives and the banks failed, then no class was safe. So the problem is, people thought that the buy and hold philosophy, which was really developed in that 1992 timeframe, that if you just bought a stock and you could hold it for 7-8 years, you would be fine. That same philosophy was still pervading into the 2008 timeframe. And so I think why most people got hurt is because they didn't realize that there really had to be a monitoring and an active look or view towards the portfolio, and really making sure that you were protected in that environment. I think people really just maybe got a little bit lazy about, and I don't mean the consumers, but I think the the financial industry and the people that serviced consumers in terms of the investments maybe got a little bit casual in thinking that if they had that asset allocation, they would be protected. You know, the securities industry is probably the most heavily regulated industry in our country. And yet, so what happens is people say, well, if I just allocate these assets to these classes, I'm safe, everything's fine. If one goes up, that's okay. The other one goes down overall over a long period of time. And of course, over the past 50, 60, 70 years, we know that investing in the markets typically has been a good strategy.
Just not in the 2000s.
But just not in the 2000s. So, and you know, we call it the lost decade. In fact, it was a negative decade. If you had had your money in the market from 2000 to 2008, you actually lost money. You were actually down, you know, 3%, a negative 3%. And we've had clients come in where, we've had people come in where they have 401ks and they actually had put more money into their 401ks than they actually made over the course of that 8 years because of the loss. So, of course, the joke was the 401ks became the 201ks. So
yeah, or here in San Diego, we called it the Coast Highway 101K.
The 101K. So, you know, the historical perspective is really helpful to understand why I think the changes occurred today. And so it really talks about what, you know, what does the future mean and how does and what are the responsibilities that you have to do going forward?
So let's talk about how some or many high net worth families are now investing. There is a general dissatisfaction with stocks and bonds and mutual funds because of, well, the things that you just talked about. So we're now seeing high net worth families move into other areas that don't provide the same amount of liquidity as obviously those investments. So therefore, they have a higher degree of risk. But it's with the hope of higher returns, things like private equity, investing in companies, buying distressed real estate or distressed debt. There's all kinds of distressed real estate and distressed debt out in the marketplace for acquisition, particularly on the West Coast, but actually almost all across the country and probably will be for another 3 or 4 years. So a lot of high net worth families are moving into different directions. I'm not convinced those families know about all of the risks inherent in doing that with regard to liquidity, certain types of systemic risk, counterparty risk. But what do you think about what these families are doing in general, Rich? I mean, do you see the same thing in your practice?
Well, when we talk about risk, you know, that's a different evaluation as I see it. You know, the risk of the particular investment has to be evaluated for the investment itself. But I think from a broader perspective, one of the things that we have to be careful of is that when we look at the fiduciary responsibilities, not only of the person doing the advising, but also if we have a situation where we have trustees of different trusts, whether they are corporate trustees or whether they're the family member, you know, the so-called child who's managing a trust for the benefit of their children or for somebody else's children, the amount of responsibility that we have to look at in balancing the risks for the beneficiaries who are potentially receiving income versus the beneficiaries who are potentially the remainder beneficiaries. And of course, that's extremely important in the generation and dynasty type trusts, where we're looking at holding on to assets for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 generations. And so these trustees have a special responsibility to make sure that those assets perform correctly. And that's what the Prudent Investor Act requires. Now, the interesting part about the Uniform Prudent Investor Act is that it can be waived. And in fact, our trust, we actually have a waiver provision so that if you have a family business that has a single asset or you're talking about these distressed assets, then the trustees certainly can invest in those assets. And assuming that they do it correctly, that they will be protected from the legal perspective.
Well, I found through observation, through 30-some years of being in this business and working with very high net worth families, that families build wealth in a non-allocated or in a very concentrated way. The family business being a real estate investor, that families typically don't build wealth through diversification. They might then later in life attempt to maintain wealth or preserve wealth through diversification, but the building part typically occurs in a very concentrated manner. You know, the business that started in the garage that became worth gazillions, or buying up tons of real estate in a certain area, you know, before the growth boom. And so that becomes very difficult for trustees because you then get into a situation, say somebody passes away in the family, so trustees are appointed, and now you have wealth, but it's concentrated. Well, that's contrary to asset allocation theory or the uniform prudent investor rule that says you shouldn't have all your eggs in one basket. So talk about what kind of stress does this put on trustees?
Well, that's correct, and it puts a lot of stress on the trustees because an evaluation is going to have to be made as to what to do with those assets. And I think I'm going to hold off, you know, revealing the answer, so to speak, I think, till our last segment here.
Good move.
But clearly, clearly those are the risks and those are the areas that we have to be careful of. For me, the biggest issue is the lawsuit question. If the trustee is not diversifying, what are the reasons for that? And I know that, unfortunately, in our industry, attorneys will sue whether you do or whether you don't. So sometimes it's a no-win position for the trustee. And so it's a very high-stress situation, and they're going to have to protect themselves and do the things that are necessary to be able to avoid those lawsuits and to be able to manage those assets correctly. Now, you know, you and I talk a lot about collaboration, and certainly a trustee has the ability to manage portfolio managers. They have the ability to get the right consultations. If there's appraisals in businesses or appraisals in properties, what are the returns that are going to occur? And certainly it would be advisable for the trustee to do that. The trustee isn't charged with the whole responsibility of analyzing all of those particular investments. So surrounding themselves with the right team is one good way to minimize those risks that anything will go wrong in the future.
So we're going to talk about this after the break too, but I want you to touch on it briefly. Following the uniform prudent investor rule, there's this thing that we sometimes use for families called investment policy statements. Can you just describe what an investment policy statement is without getting into any implications of what it is?
Put it simply, I would say it's a roadmap. It's a roadmap for the family as to how their investments are going to be managed.
And why would families want to do that? Again, without getting into how to do this, why would they want to do it? Not it's a leading question, Richard.
In
addition to the financial reasons, why else would they want to do this?
Well, yeah, the most significant is that it's really setting out, in my opinion, the purpose of the family, where the family is going, what their vision is, how they want to get there. So that roadmap has guideposts for the family to do that. It sets out the highest level of what the family wants to accomplish for themselves. And so as you develop that inside a family, then you have a measuring stick. You have something that you can look at and say, is this working? Is this right? Is it what the family still wants to accomplish? And it's something that's active and ongoing as opposed to a one-time event that you stick away and you never see again, which dovetailing back to our estate tax and estate planning conversation, really is valuable because when you look at doing a plan and having those purpose and visions laid out, you can constantly monitor that rather than having something fail at the end.
Absolutely agreed. Again, it's Your Money, Not Theirs, appropriately named for this topic. We'll be right back. Thanks. My goodness, how time flies. We're in our last segment, and it's going to be a short one. It's Your Money, Not Theirs, with our special guest, San Diego County's best estate planning attorney, Rich Gaines. So, Rich, this show is about, well, people think this show is about money, but it's really about wealth. And for me, there's three kinds of wealth. Actually, there's four kinds of wealth. There is money and assets, but there's also what I call intellectual capital or knowledge. There's also what I call human capital, people. And then lastly, there might be community capital, how families interact with their communities to make them better places and improve communities where their people live and work and so on. So let's talk about people, and let's talk about one of the objectives of something that I do a lot of, which is called family governance, which is making sure that family members thrive, not just financially, but also in their relationships, with regard to their education, with regard to their participation in their communities. Investment policy statements sort of define how we invest money, but isn't there an underlying fundamental document or statement such as a vision or mission statement that a family should have? Because to me, it really depends on what is it the family's trying to accomplish, not only today, but even generations, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 generations, 50 years down the road. Can you comment, please?
Our message is very similar. When I talk about wealth, I talk about wealth not just in the money, but also in values, in traditions, and the beliefs. And when we talk about those ideas, when we look at the different statements that a family can prepare, we start with a purpose. What is the unique features of what a family is? What makes them special? What's their special story? What makes them different than anyone else? To me, that's really the vibrant part of a family, is really understanding who they are and how they operate and what they can do for themselves today and into the future. So that really gets into the purpose of the family. And after that, then we start breaking it down into the things that I think you're focused on, which is the vision statement. So what is the family passionate about? What is it that they want to accomplish with their business? So what kind of culture do they want to create? Do they want to, what kind of jobs do they want to provide to people? What kind of community do they want to develop around themselves? The mission statement to me is more about the goal setting. So once we have the purpose of the family really defined, we then can, and we have the vision statement set out, then we really can start to narrow down what the goals are, that which we call the stepping stones to get them to that vision.
So you're saying vision statement comes first, then the mission follows, because that's sort of the goal setting process.
Correct. That's how I look at it.
And then the investment policy statements would follow, depending on what the family is actually trying to accomplish, both in the present time as well as with regard to future generations.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's where we get into the discussion of the single asset investment, where you were talking about distressed debt. Those types of investments, because if the family's purpose is to grow wealth, and if they've chosen real estate as the model for that, and their vision is to maybe provide a lot of rental properties, then buying distressed debt where they can hold on to that and utilize it in the real estate portfolio would then be very advantageous for people going into the future.
So would these documents and statements look different between two families? Let's say the first family is multi-generational and they're very concerned about the legacy that they're leaving in their community. And let's say the second family's main goal in life is to fly their Learjet to Aspen every weekend to go skiing.
Well, just the fact you bring it up clearly shows the distinction. And clearly a lot of families are different. I've had clients where they are very high net worth, and yet we're only talking about two or three members of the family because of the age of the business owner. So it's kind of interesting, because then the question is, what do you do with a person like that? They don't have kids. They don't have grandkids. It's not multi-generational at that point in time. And so what is the real purpose of that individual? Whereas you have another family, we were talking off air. I've had a family where we did planning back all the way back to 2000, and it was extremely successful planning. The children of the family have a lifestyle. They did not want to be involved in the family business. The granddaughter wanted to be involved in the family business and is doing so. The matriarch of the family is still alive. She's a very generous and giving person. But that family has been set up for multi-generations throughout the different entities that we created. And we have great-grandkids in that family. So there's enormous differences in what we can do in the planning for the different families because of that.
And one of the challenges, of course, becomes family communication, does it not? Because many companies or businesses are built with what we call a very vertical decision-making model. That is to say, the one founder or the two founders make all the decisions. But as wealth moves among generations, that decision model can be very risky, because as you add generations, many family members feel like they don't have a voice, or their voice isn't being listened to.
That's probably one of the worst things that can happen inside a family on a vertical structure, is when you have a family member that's not being respected. I think that's where lawsuits come from. I think that's where certainly the disenfranchisement of a particular family member and not feeling that they're getting their due, members of the family not working in the family business. So we like to collapse that down more towards a horizontal structure.
Yeah, that's why I think your approach is so incredible, because you're one of the few people I've ever met who actually approaches this in the way that you do. So hats off to you.
Thank you.
Again, it's Your Money, Not Theirs. We are out of time. This show is dedicated to my dog, Benny, who passed away this afternoon. Join us next week on It's Your Money, Not Theirs. And I think we're going to have a new name next week. See ya. Rich, thanks.
Thank you.